Welcome to the Unconventional Dyad Podcast, where you'll find broad topics, an unconventional dyad, and one shared goal, educating ourselves through challenging and engaging conversations. Your hosts are Carly and Laura, two graduate students and friends committed to having discussions that are real, raw, and unpolished. Thank you for joining us. Welcome to episode 19 of the Unconventional Dyad Podcast, where Carly and I interview Wendy Irvin, who is an educator and has been teaching high school for over a decade. Wendy earned her undergraduate degree in English and secondary education from Chicago State University and a master's degree in school counseling from Governor State University. She is a huge advocate for students and was nominated for Teacher of the Year in 2019. She currently serves as an English teacher, intervention specialist, digital portfolio team lead, and mentor teacher in North Carolina. She was also my mentor teacher when I was student teaching a few years ago in Chicago, and I can truly say that Wendy is one of the most engaging, passionate, and hardworking educators out there. We discuss several topics on the podcast today, including teaching during the COVID-19 and the racism pandemics, the intersection of education and counseling, the joys and challenges of encouraging engagement and critical thinking in the classroom, Wendy's hopes and plans for the future, and many other incredible topics. You definitely don't want to miss this episode. Carly and I had a lot of fun with this one, and we didn't want the conversation to stop. So we hope you enjoy this interview just as much as we did. And as always, thanks for being with us. All right, Wendy, thank you so much for being here with us today on the Unconventional Dyad Podcast.
Thank you so much. It's such a privilege. I feel so honored.
Oh my gosh, it's a privilege for us. We are so excited to have you on. Why don't we start with you just talking a little bit about who you are, what your personal and professional identities are?
So it's so hard because I've been teaching now for 13 years. I'm a high school English teacher, and it's so hard to separate that from like who I am. It's like, wait, I'm something else. Like, I'm a wife now, but sometimes my husband's like, hey, I'm not one of your students. And I'm like, I'm sorry. You know, like it's just in me, you know, I'm that person in the grocery store when the kid starts asking questions, I want to help and explain. And it's just in my nature. So I think I'm a teacher, honestly, at heart, even though it's a profession that I fell into by accident. Who would have thought that it would be like it's genuinely who I feel I am. So and then the other aspect of my personal identity is I'm the oldest. And if anybody knows anything about birth order, I am that girl. Far more independent than my siblings. And then also, too, I have a little bit of the only child syndrome because I was the only child by 8. And, you know, your temperament and all of that is set by that point. So I'm a brat and I'm the oldest. And so, yeah, go figure. So that's who I am. But it's interesting, too, because the flip side of that, I think, by me being the oldest, I think it really created a breeding ground for the nurturer that I've grown to become, right? And so while I can be a little spoiled and fussy sometimes, I hold myself to a high standard. And I also, you know, I look for that in others and I try my best to nurture people into being their best. So that's who I am.
Amazing. So tell us a little bit about your teaching journey, because you said you fell into it accidentally. What was that all about?
So ironically enough, I wanted to be a child psychiatrist, or so I thought. Counseling has always been my passion and psychology. I didn't quite understand that a psychiatrist, I was just looking at the doctor thing. My mom is a nurse. My mom, when she got pregnant with me, she wanted to go to med school. And she reminded me of how I kind of, you know, I stopped that for her. And so I've always aspired to be a doctor, but I didn't know that psychiatrists, you know, pretty much they kind of push pills. And it's not to say that they don't counsel, but, you know, they're more so on the medical side of it. And so when I got to undergrad, I realized that I would like to be a psychologist, right? But coming out of undergrad with a degree in psychology is like a degree in communications. No offense to anyone who has that, right? It's a great building block, but it's so broad and it's so hard to compete and it's hard to make a living. So my junior year of undergrad, I went and changed my major. I was a double minor in psychology and sociology, and I majored in English and education, which of course put me on a trajectory for a 6-year plan instead of four. Smart move, Wendy. And so that's kind of where I am. But I did pick up the counseling in 2012. I went back and got my master's in school counseling. So I still dip and dab with it here and there. I do make sure though to get that counseling piece in. In addition to advocating for kids, I make sure to build that social emotional learning into my classroom and curriculum literally every day, especially now during COVID. So I kind of fell into it. I thought that I would get into education and eventually go back to school and like really pursue my doctorate degree in psychology. But I don't know. I'm kind of it's an awkward place to be in because I'm comfortable, but I'm not. You know what I mean? Like, which is why I'm in grad school again. I'm going for
Not
punishment.
surprised.
And currently, right now, I'm in grad school for administration, school administration. So hopefully, I can fulfill some of that counseling on a greater level than if I were just no offense to school counselors, but I'll be able to hopefully apply some of those skills on a larger scale now.
Right. Yeah, definitely. That's really exciting. When I first heard that you were going into admin kind of stuff, I was really excited for you. I can totally see you in that role. And I should mention for our listeners too that Wendy was my mentor teacher when I was student teaching a few years ago. And so this is how I know Wendy, and I can totally see the counseling piece. I mean, you counseled me like how many times when I was crying in the classroom?
And when we'll get to it if a little later, but you have no idea the impact you made on me. You are part of the main reason why I decided to step into administration. When I was in, and we'll get to how I ended up here as well, but I'm from Chicago. I've always taught in Chicago. I just moved to Raleigh, North Carolina, 4 years ago in March. And so while I was in Chicago, my administration would always try to get me into administration, right? Like they'd always be pushing these programs. And I'm like, I don't want your job, right? Like I make great money as a teacher without all your stress. And then, but it's been something that I was interested in, but I just didn't want the responsibility. But then thinking about the impact that I had on you, or just being around you and watching you grow. I've not quite been able to find anything as fulfilling as that. And I mean, I'm fulfilled in teaching my kids, don't get me wrong. And there's something amazing when kids, they don't appreciate you when they have you, but there's nothing like that email you get from a kid 3, 4, 5 years later when they're in college and they're like, Miss Joshua, I'm learning about such and such. I had a kid literally screenshot the board and she was like, I got this, right? And I was like, you better, Those things are really, really, really huge and pivotal. But imagine what that would look like if I could impart that knowledge to teachers. So imagine the scope that I would be able to have if I could, instead of just giving myself to students, if I could spread a little bit of me out and have teachers actually do those things. And so you've impacted me far more than you can imagine. So thank you.
Oh my gosh, that makes me want to tear up hearing that. That's awesome. So let's talk a little bit about your teaching journey because you taught in Chicago and you taught in a lot of different types of schools, and now you're in the South. So what happened?
Man, oh man. Well, I ended up here because my best friend from high school, she has multiple sclerosis, and her mom passed away, I don't know, maybe about 7, 8 years ago now. And she moved down here with her dad. And 4 years ago, her brother called and told me that her dad was on hospice. And so I came to visit her. And when I came down here, I didn't like how she looked. And it was no one's fault, but multiple sclerosis is a degenerative disease. And so it progressively, eats away at your muscles. And your brain is a muscle. And so she had just kind of deteriorated a lot, in my opinion, from the last time I'd seen her. And so I was like, I got to get down here. And so everybody thought I was joking. So this was in like August that I visited. And when I tell you by that next February, I was living here. Like I had packed up and we won't even talk about the salary, the difference in pay, my word, what was I thinking? But I don't regret it for one moment because the time that I've been able to spend with her, the way that I've been able to have a hand in her care and making sure that she's provided for, even though she's in a nursing facility now, I wouldn't trade it for the world. And so that's how I ended up here. But in coming here, wow, you talk about, I visited the South maybe a few times, but you see things in movies and you're like, that's not real. And then you get here and you're like, whoa, that's real. So here's what I mean. I'm an avid runner prior to COVID, but when I moved here, I joined this group of young African American women who run, right? Black girls run. There you go. So we're just running along and running along, and I stopped to tie my shoe. We were in downtown Raleigh. I stopped to tie my shoe, and when I looked up, I was like, "Holy crap! That's a Confederate statue, like right there." And I had paid. I didn't. In Chicago, we have monuments. You know what I mean? Like, there's a huge one in Washington Park, right? So I'm like looking, and I said, "Hey, ladies, do you all see that?" And they're like, "Yeah." I'm like, "And we're okay with this?" And they're like, "I mean, yeah, it's always been there." And I was like, "Oh my word, never in a million years would you see that anywhere in Chicago." I mean, you could even go to some of the super racially, because Chicago's one of the most segregated cities in the country. You can't even get that in Evergreen, or what's the one where all the cops live? I can't think. It's over in that same area, but it's notorious for being very racist, right? You can't even get a Confederate statue over there, though, right? And so that was the first indicator of what I'd moved into. And it's interesting because one thing that I can honestly say I've learned here, and I don't know if it's a good or a bad thing, but I'm definitely learning to curb my tongue, right? And it's interesting because my grandma used to always say, she was a woman of parables, honey, but she used to always say, a still tongue makes a wise head. And as a little girl, you stay in a child's place. You act like a lady and all of these things, but a still tongue makes a wise head. Honey, when I tell you, who would have known almost 40 years later that I would be applying those life lessons from my grandma when I was a kid? And it's amazing. I'm very outspoken and I speak up when it comes to injustice. Like I started a restorative justice program at Collins Academy before I left Chicago, right? Like I'm all for equity. And it's not just about black and brown kids, but I'm all for equity. And to come here and see that, and it was just like, oh my gosh, but I'm learning how to play the game and kind of, tither in and out of spaces. And yeah, I'm learning the significance and the power of that still tongue. And sometimes, as much as I want to, the Chicago big city girl in me is like, you go for it, right? But you can't just go for it down here because the majority, or I don't even say the majority, there are enough people here who are completely against that, right? There are enough people here who they are having fights as we speak about Confederate statues, right? And there's so many people who want them. So me being a little loudmouth girl from the city, this isn't my town. You better watch your mouth and mind your manners, right? And so I'm learning how to adjust, and I'm hoping that having a platform by which I am allowed to teach children, not necessarily teach them that anything is right or wrong, but giving them the resources and giving them the information so that they can best make decisions for themselves, I think would be pivotal. Right. And I think as an administrator, having a school where teachers are able to freely give students choice, it's not about me imparting my beliefs, because who's to say my beliefs are the best way, right? But giving kids an opportunity, and I think that that's what we miss here. so many kids are inundated with their parents' beliefs and the status quo because that's what we do here. It's business as usual. And it's so deeply woven into the education system here that the kids don't even know why, but this is what we do. This is how we feel, right? With no idea about like the history behind it, with no idea about how that may be impacting someone else. You know, you can literally have a kid who, you can have a white student who may have a black friend, but their parents, you know, support the Confederacy. That kid doesn't get why that may be offensive to that black friend. And so I think being in a position, or I hope being in a position where equity is the norm. You know what I mean? Equity, and every kid deserves it, right? Like, I don't care, black, brown, white, everybody deserves it. Disabled, able-bodied, everybody, LGBTQ, everybody deserves equity, right? Everybody deserves the same opportunities. Now, what you do with those opportunities, what you do with that information is totally your business. But I think here, you know, they call it the Bible Belt for a reason, and it is those Christian values, and there's nothing wrong with good Christian values, but I think that in some cases it does impede or hinder some of our children's progress with regards to them being able to be more open-minded, with them being able to accept diversity, with them being able to step outside of their comfort zone and try new things. And so, yeah, I'm hoping that I'll be able to maybe, you know, change the trajectory for some of these kids, you know, and just giving them options and saying that this is a different way of looking at it. Now, you can look at it this way or not, but at least exposing them, because I think so many of my students and my kids, they don't have options for exposure. What they get at home, and it's not to say that what they get at home is wrong, but that is like it, you know, like they're in these little boxes and that's it. And there's a whole world outside of that box, right? There are lots of different types of people, and they miss that.
Wow. I have so many questions for you. Oh my gosh. What is it like, I guess, just broadly speaking, what is it like to be a black teacher there?
I don't know if I can find an appropriate adjective, but I can try to describe it. So I often feel like, so let's be clear. In Chicago, I was extremely comfortable in my skin. I didn't feel like I had to compete. I didn't feel like I had to dumb my curriculum down for my kids, nor did I feel like I had to beat them into submission, right? Like, I was comfortable. I taught. I had good scores. Like, I did what I was supposed to do. I was relatively well respected from the staff and the students alike. Everything was good. Now, it wasn't just a perfect situation. We all know with politics in Chicago, you see it all the time on the news. Everybody knows about Chicago politics, right? They're messy, they're sloppy, they're even worse than education. So, you know, I don't want to have rose-colored glasses when I speak about my experience in Chicago because it wasn't a walk in the park. Every day wasn't great. You know, coming from a school like Collins, where I had, you know, in the 2 week period, I had two students be murdered. Literally, one Sunday was one student. And then the following Sunday, on Mother's Day, one of my best and favorite students was murdered, right? And so you can imagine someone being really into feelings and emotions as with that counseling background, that shook my core and hurt my heart, right? And then you come here and it's almost like a fight to prove yourself, but not even with just like staff, because this is a new staff. Like, they don't know me from a can of paint, right? They don't know, they see a resume and it looks good, right? But they don't really know me. So, okay, I get that part. But I have never in my life felt like I had to prove myself to children. Do you know what I mean? Like, and granted, coming from Chicago, if anyone knows, I didn't realize we have an accent. Who knew, right? And so my husband is from New Jersey, and he's like, you all don't pronounce the word endings. You know, you say ka instead of car. And I don't know. I can't think of any other words, but I'm sure I'll fling some around ever so casually. And he constantly reminds me of that, right? In Chicago, I was never judged by that, right? Like, I don't know if you see, but there are a couple of degrees on the wall, right? Like, I'm not an idiot. You know what I mean? Like, and so I feel here, and I don't know if that's the extent of the judgment. I'm pretty sure that's not it. But I just recently had a student, okay? He had a question about a grade, and this was a white student. It's okay. I love him to pieces, but I was very taken aback by this. So I met with him privately. I told him I would meet with him on Google Meet so that I could project my screen. I could show him the grade book and we could talk about his grade because he was emailing me all these numbers and things, right? And I couldn't understand what he was trying to convey. And so I met with him, I projected it. I showed him the weighting categories and we kind of went through this whole thing and he kept saying, but no, you don't understand. Da, 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 da. And I said, okay, that's fine. This child who is a freshman said, well, would you like me to write it down for you? Who are you talking to? It's everything out of me to not turn into something very unprofessional, right? Because that's a child. He's like 14, 13, 14. And the way that he said it, the tone that he took, I don't think if I were a different teacher of another race, I don't think that he would have been that comfortable in saying that to me, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I've had several students, and that's the most recent incident, but I've had several students over my time here, you know, throughout my time here, say things like that to me. Like the nerve, you would never tell your boss, even if you think your boss is wrong, do you need me to write that down for you? I mean, because and the inference behind that was because clearly you don't get it. So let me break it down. I'm like, no, ma'am, no, sir. How does that work? And so I find myself every year kind of in the middle of situations like that with students. I just took a breather. When he said it, I tried my best to keep my facial expressions the same. And I was just like, well, you know, no, I don't need you to write it down, but what I'm going to show you is what we have and where we are, right? And like, this is it. I don't know. I don't know. Like, I don't know what to tell you, but this is what it is, right? And this is why it is. Whatever you're talking about over there, I don't know mathematically what you're saying. Doesn't matter. This is where we are, right? Stick to the facts. That's what I'm learning in my graduate program, right? Stick to the facts. Keep your feelings out of it. Stick to the facts. And I mean, ultimately, the conversation, it ended up going well. Eventually, he kind of was like, okay, I guess. And we kind of agreed to disagree and left it alone. But just the mere fact that a student would approach me with that kind of language and tone was very off-putting because I have never, ever, ever, ever had an African-American student. And that doesn't mean that an African-American student wouldn't try me, right? They've never felt comfortable enough to speak to me in that way. Whereas here, it's fairly commonplace, right? And that's students, that's parents, some staff members, you know, it's a very interesting position to be in. I found over the years that I've been here, oftentimes I'm not heard. Now, administration, they listen. But some of my colleagues, not so much, right? And it's like I'm constantly trying to prove, excuse me, I'm constantly trying to prove that I know what I'm talking about. You know what I mean? Like in Chicago, I was on the assessment team for AUSL developing the assessments for the district, right? For all the AUSL schools. I held several leadership positions. I was on the IOT. I was the department chair. I was a grade level lead. I helped hire mentees into the program to become teachers in the first place, right? Like, I'm not just a run-of-the-mill Joe Schmo. I kind of know a little bit. I mean, I'm not an expert, but like, I think I've earned my stripes for you to listen sometimes. And it's an ongoing uphill battle to get people to listen, no matter how it's presented.
I mean, I would argue that you are an expert. I mean, I learned so much from you, and not just me, but I know a lot of people learned a lot from you. And I do remember you being very well respected, especially at the school we were working at. And yeah, I mean, you know, you've had several years of experience. You have a background in multiple different fields. That's crazy. That just sounds really exhausting.
It is. But one thing, you know, I'm just going to keep giving NC State's their principal fellows. I'm just going to keep giving them, you know, all the praise because I'm looking at my books now. So like when I look over there, don't think that I'm like spacing out, but you know, Carnegie, How to Win Friends and Influence People, super critical and important. Crucial Conversations, I live my life by Crucial Conversations. And so one thing I can say, despite the frustration, the counselor in me always wants to look at the why in people, right? So before I get in my feelings, I always try to say like, well, why might they feel this way? Why may they be receiving me this way? Is it the way in which I'm presenting myself to them? Is it my tone? Is it my affect and body language? Like, what am I doing, right? And when I try, and I'm not perfect, right? But I do think I reflect. I think about these things. You know what I mean? Like, and so I'll try to come back at things with different angles. Like, you know, Carnegie talks about having this mutual need, right? Like, hey, we all need to get these test scores up. What if we all did this, right? Like, I put myself in the mix. I'm not telling you to do something. I'm saying, hey, can we work together to do something different, right? And I just keep trying to package it differently. I mean, because as a leader, the strife that I may have or may have had, you know, at my current school, it's going to be magnified when I become a leader, right? And if I can't deal and I can't handle it amongst colleagues and peers on a day-to-day basis or, you know, within the time that I've been at my school, how am I going to manage a school full of, you know, teachers, right? So I take it all with a grain of salt. I'm learning. I mean, I'm still, and this is a very trying time right now. You know what I mean? And I give people grace with that too, because I think, you know, the term we use quite frequently is we're building a plane while we fly it, right? And so knowing that and understanding that, and also understanding how it's easier for people to just do what they know, that may be,
right?
You know, and so, I mean, that goes with kids, that goes with parents, that goes for faculty and staff. And so you just, every day you get back up and you try again, but it is an ongoing fight. Some days are better than others. And it's not a terrible experience. I don't want anybody to think like, oh my God, why is she still teaching or whatever. But I think these are the realities, especially being someone who's not from here. I think if I were from here, it may not be as obvious to me, right? You know, so it's amazing to me what teachers have to do here because they don't have a union.
Oh my gosh, I didn't know that.
No, there's no union. And so they call, this is a right to work state. And that means that they don't unionize. Certain professions have unions, but teachers, we do not. And so what that means is when I got down here and they started talking about all these different duties, like hall duty and well, we did tardy sweepers and stuff in CPS, but it was like 5 minutes, no harm, no foul. It wasn't like this big to do. But I mean, lunch duty, tardies, just different things to like manage the building, right? It's placed on the shoulders in a lot of cases of teachers. And I was like, wait, y'all do that? You know what I mean? Like, or if a teacher is out and they can't get a sub, they can call another teacher and say, hey, I need you to go cover that class. Wait, no, this is my prep. It's sacred. No, it's not. You go cover that class. And so there's so many things that are just so different. I think that down here, more so, and it's so funny because in Chicago, I thought that teachers were so disrespected. No one cares about teachers and we're just so overlooked and it's such a disrespected profession. And then I moved down here and I was like, oh honey, wait, you have no idea. If you didn't think it could get worse, it can.
Wow.
But I think that's something that's like, that would be bigger than me as an administrator, right? As an administrator, I feel like my role would be to absolutely try to make sure that my staff knows and understands how much I appreciate them, right? So despite, because I can't change things on a state level, right? But what I can do is I can write you notes to let you know that I appreciate you. I can recognize you for things when you're doing things well. I can check in on you and make sure you're okay and ask how I can be of service to you, because ultimately I can't run a school without you, right? And I think it's those little things that will make all the world of a difference despite, you know, all of these other things. But when I got down here and they were talking about duties and I was like, why don't you all have a union? And I will never forget, this lady is a friend of mine. And she was like, oh honey, you shouldn't have become a teacher then. because this is a right to work state and we don't unionize. If you didn't want to be here, you didn't want to, you shouldn't have taught. And I was like, like, so you're okay with them beating you? Like, you're, it's almost like the slaves when they'd be like, don't you run away. Don't you go get free.
Right.
So you can still tell me it's okay, huh? All right. Well, I'll be.
And that's, wow. So it's a whole
different world. Yeah, it's a whole different world. And teachers, I think, are afraid. They're so fearful here of, you know, like, when things aren't working well, they're afraid to stand up. Whereas in Chicago, we're waiting for, we are on the edge of our seats. Not that we look forward to a strike, because no one wants to miss their money. And contrary to popular belief, we genuinely miss our kids. We are striking, standing outside in the cold, because it usually happens during the colder seasons. I don't know if you noticed that. We don't usually strike in the heat. You know, I've been out bundled up in sweaters and hats and scarves and boots and thermals and all this stuff. We're not, I would so prefer to be in a warm classroom in front of my students, right? It's never like, at least I get a day off. It's not a day off. It's a whole day in the cold, right?
Right.
But collectively, we realize that that's what's necessary to get the things that we need in order for us to better serve our kids. Whereas down here, they're terrified. Well, if we don't go to work and they don't pay us, and what if they fire us? And not knowing that they're not knocking down the doors to become teachers, right? So, like, if enough of you say we can't deal with this, or this is too much, or we deserve better, someone's going to have to fold and give you better, right?
Yeah.
But they don't. It's a whole nother world. I've given up that crusade within the first couple of months of being here. I just conform. I'm like, oh, a bunch of duties. Let's do them.
Wow. Yeah. And on top of that, I mean, you've got multiple pandemics going on, most notably the COVID-19 pandemic and the racism pandemic. And it sounds like that's, I didn't even think about the context that you're in on top of those things happening. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about how it's been to teach in the midst of these pandemics.
You know, the conundrum for this question is bountyless, because I am in a very awkward position. So, you know, I thrive on student engagement. I believe it's my personal philosophy, especially when you come from a school where we were, where, you know, it was a lower performing school and everybody said what these kids can't do and how they're just not smart and they're labeled as all of these negative things. And I'm like, oh, no, but my kids can and they will. And guess what they did, right? Like, there were things that our kids were able to do that people were like, I bring it back to my department. They're like, how'd you get them to argue like this? And how did you get them to write like this? Mm-hmm. I say, how do you not? Right. But the engagement is the key. Right. And so if you're engaging kids, even when it's rigorous, look at that. They'll do it because they're interested. Right. And so when we think about, like, skill based learning, which is my heart, it's my pride, it is my baby. Of course, UBD, backwards by design, you know, making sure that you pick the standards and you build your lessons around those. But that engagement is so critical. And I think we often forget how important it is, because as teachers now, this is pre-COVID, we are competing with social media. We are competing with TV and phones. And when I was in high school, we didn't have cell phones like that. I had a pager. I'm dating myself here. I had a pager. All right. You know, and so I couldn't just whip out my page and start scrolling through and seeing what my friends were doing. So, you know what I mean? Like, we're competing with these things. And so I feel like if we can't engage them, like, what I'm doing has to be more interesting than that. I got to be more interesting than TikTok. Mm. I got to be more interesting than Instagram, right? Because kids will whip out their phones in a minute, honey. And they'll be like, it's my mom. And just scroll on through. And so, coming down here, I think that we miss those opportunities for that engagement piece, and we miss it. And it's even worse now that we're online. You know, a lot of teachers want to do the same things that they did in the classroom and just make it, you know, make the worksheets editable now, right? Like, that's not engaging kids. And so I'm constantly doing and looking for new. I use Nearpod, I use Pear Deck, I'll use Flipgrid. I'm like a magician. I'm like, and I'm not saying that it's great, it's not, trust me. It is I am a part of the dumpster fire of 2020, I will admit. But the goal is to continuously be learning so that it can be a constant evolution and I should constantly be improving, right? None of us have the answers, but right now it's just so hard because, so the engagement piece is the first part that I think is huge. And I think we miss opportunities there. I think now is the time. If you have ever wanted to try something, now's the time to do it, honey. I don't care what that thing is. If it's something that you can make electronic, now's the time to try it, right? Like, who's going to judge you for trying to do better? The other aspect of it is, and this is where I struggle with my counseling. I know I have so many, I have kids who have been committed, right? I know kids who've had mental breakdowns. I know kids, I have spoken to so many parents of kids who are, they're breaking, they're hurting, and it's messing with my ethics as a teacher and my ethics as a counselor. Right now, they are in constant battle, and they're constantly at a tug of war because my core as a teacher is like, well, you still hold kids accountable, the world still moves. And it's not to say that you're not empathetic, but it's to say that you can't just stop. So like, what is enough? Right. What is fair without breaking them more, right? And then the counselor in me is like, but they're hurting. And I can't imagine what it must be like. I've had kids who've contracted COVID. I have kids who've lost people to COVID. I have kids whose parents still have not let them really leave the house since March. You know, like I have some parents who are like, hey, they just, you know, like whatever, it's over, or so they think. And we're kind of all over the place. And I know these kids more so than ever are so socially awkward and inept to begin with, right? Their friends and their base for their friendships most of it is online, right? Which is in a lot of cases a false sense of friendship and security, but that's a whole nother thing that we'll talk about in another podcast. But the only socialization many of them get in some instances is when they come to school, right? When they are in extracurricular activities, which have all been aborted at this point. And so it hurts me to think that I cannot engage these kids as much as I would like to, or as much as I would be able to in the classroom, right? Stockpiled with that anxiety, that depression, you know, that isolation that so many of them are feeling. And so it's a constant battle. And I feel so bad because when I talk to parents, I'm honest with them and I tell them, I don't know. And usually I tell parents, well, you just sit down, just check it. Or, you know, if you get him a planner, it'll help him be organized. Or, you know, like I can usually tell parents something to kind of help them with their kids. But now I find myself like, I don't know, for parents who are comfortable, I will suggest, I'll say, well, have you considered counseling? You know, it's a really tough time right now, but you know, you have to tread lightly with talking to people about counseling because you have people who don't agree with it, people who don't believe in it, people who think religiously it's wrong, all of these different things, and trying to feel out where parents are with that is huge. But what I do to kind of settle the score with my counselor ethics and my teaching ethics, every day we have our do nows are something related to social emotional learning. So Mondays is mindfulness Mondays. We do a mindfulness activity. So we've done meditation. Who knew that they like it? And I mean, I do a temperature check after and they like it. One boy went to sleep and I was like, baby, it was only 3 minutes. Come on back. Like, you know, some Mondays we do mindfulness meditation. Other Mondays we'll do mindfulness things. So think about something nice you could have said to someone. Think about, explain, you know, your favorite place in your home. How does it make you feel? Like, we do something like that. So Monday is mindfulness Mondays. Tuesdays is tell me about it Tuesday. So they have to tell me something. And I write prompts each day to kind of guide them. Wednesday is wellness Wednesday. So we talk, and Wednesdays are usually asynchronous at my school. And I don't always get to see them, but for Asynchronous Wednesdays, what I do is I'll Google like a wellness calendar for the month. And sometimes I'll let them pick the day. Sometimes we'll just do the actual day, but we'll talk about something that they can do for their own wellness, right? Like what, it was so interesting. Last couple weeks ago, we talked about I told them that they had to go outside and observe something in nature that they hadn't paid attention to before and come back and talk to me about it, right? And it was so weird hearing them talk about, like, there's this tree and it has this little etching in it. But they do it, so I think it's cute. Thursday is Thankful Thursday, so we do something with gratitude. And Friday is either Feedback Friday, where I give them feedback or they give me some, or it's Freedom Friday. So Freedom Friday, today's prompt was, does social media help or hinder your freedom and why, right? And so that's my way of checking in with them every day with some kind of social, emotional, like dipstick and temperature check, right? But I mean, aside from that, it's really hard because I don't see them. And I'm very good about building relationships and I have great rapport with my kids. It's going to burn my soul to not be able to hug my babies when we go back to school because I am that teacher. You know, I meet you at the door, I smile, I hug you, we dap it up, we talk, and you come in, you sit down, and now it's going to be like, oh, so. But it's been very, very, very difficult. The failure rates right now for students is astonishing. Is it fair? Is it equitable? Is it accurate? I cannot say yes to any of those, but it's where we are. So trying to navigate ways around that, trying to navigate modifying assignments, meeting kids where they are, exempting them from some. I think I'm working far harder now. And I know you mentioned before we started about how I'll be the first teacher in the building and the last to leave, but I think I'm working harder now from home than I've probably ever worked in 13 years of teaching. And I only teach for 45 minutes and my lessons when we're in class are about 90 minutes because we're on a block schedule. So that half of a class is taking me out as opposed to, you know, planning for twice as much now.
Yeah, you mentioned this idea of having to hold a student's interest. And I find that such an interesting and sad realization, kind of reality, that you have to, in order for them to learn, you have to hold their interest. It's not learning to acquire knowledge. It's not learning for the kind of bettering oneself. It's legitimately holding their interest, maybe even forcing them into something that they don't want to do. I when I was in school, I didn't feel that way. And I feel like things have changed over the last few decades.
It definitely has changed because I came from the era of sit and get, right? You sat there, the teacher gave it to you, and you got it. We took notes and all of those things, and we got it. But it's interesting, though, because, yes, I do feel like a court jester sometimes. Like I'm putting on a show, and it sometimes can be theatrical, right? But it reminds me of, and I'm not a parent, but it reminds me of what I would like to think it would be if I were a parent when you Jedi mind trick your kid. They don't know that they really like carrots and green stuff. They don't know just how delicious some spinach can taste with the right seasoning, right? But they see that stuff on that green plate and they're like, oh, no, ma'am. So you have to find creative ways to get that kid to eat that spinach, right? And so for me, I think that kids genuinely do want to learn because if they did, none of them would ever show up. They don't have to show up for this virtual stuff. Like they don't know what's really going to happen. My attendance is relatively good. In fact, I could argue that it's great despite COVID, right? Like I have one class, there are like 36 students in there. And on average, I get 34 to 36 students, okay? And so I say that simply to say that I think part of what makes education fun and interesting for me is the evolution. It is the fact that it's changing. I think I would probably drink myself to sleep every night if all I taught were classics every day, every year for the last 13 years. Like, give me a break. Just how much I love The Catcher in the Rye. It is my favorite. But how many times would I gouge my eyes out if that was my life every year, right? And so I think that engagement piece, it keeps it fresh. And it can be a struggle, though, because you literally do have to jump through sometimes some extreme hoops. But it's so amazing when kids appreciate it afterwards. Like they didn't know that they wanted it. They didn't know that they needed it. But yet they do know because they show up. right? So it's one of those things. It's like when your parents tell you, you know, oh, just live. You'll appreciate it when you get older. Just my mom's telling me, and my mom still tells me, oh, just live. And I'm looking back and I'm like, gosh, you were so right, right? Like your parents tell you about all the different relationships you're going to have. And you're like, you don't understand, mom. I love him. We're going to be together forever. Because I don't remember that dude anymore, but I remember that conversation with my mom, right? So it's like when your parents are trying to, like I said, in some cases, Jedi mind trick you into things. And it's also that idea of, I hate to say it, but like we do know best, right? And you have to find out how best to teach your kids what they need to know best, you know? And so, you know, you're right. It's a different generation. You know, these kids have everything easily accessible at their fingertips. So I spoke about teaching the classics before. I had someone tell me, if they can Google it, you shouldn't teach it. Is that a word? If they can Google it, you shouldn't teach it. Wow. Now, does that mean that we don't ever read classic lit? Absolutely not. But that does mean that those old school multiple choice questions that they can just Google the answers to, that's not the way that we should be assessing them with that content anymore. Now we have to ask higher order thinking questions. Now we have to be a little bit more creative with our projects. Now we have to get kids. When I was coming up, we didn't make text to world connections. I learned literary analysis in a bubble. You know what I mean? I was in my own little stratosphere doing this stuff that was totally separate from anything in my life. Now, part of my engagement is trying to get my students to see, okay, The Catcher in the Rye is super old. I get it. Holden Caulfield is, but you mean to tell me none of you all have, your sister, your siblings never got on your, you have never felt like grown-ups don't understand you in real life? You mean to tell me you can't see it? You've never been spoiled. Come on now, right? And so when you present it in that way, it's like, wait a minute, I can't see myself in this little well-to-do white kid, right? Like, who comes from this borderline aristocratic family and I'm poor and I'm Black. I can see myself in him now. And so finding those loopholes and finding those ways to build those connections, I think that is what it's all about. When I was growing up, there was no, my teachers didn't have to be creative like that, because I came up in the Dewey Decimal System, sweetheart. When you want to get a book, you go to the library, you look in the card catalog, you find that card, you go look up those numbers and those alphabets and you grab that book. My kids now can Google that book. So, you know, you just have to be a little more crafty in your approach to getting kids to do that literary, because they can still do that literary analysis, but now we need to be asking better questions, right? We need to be doing different things and allowing them to really make those connections. Those connections are the key now. And so I enjoy it. I think I would get bored if I taught the same thing every year. I've rewritten curriculum just about. So who knew?
You are the reason, Wendy, why I feel like, or you're like the prime example of why I truly believe that like the humanities are the key to saving humanity, for lack of a better phrase. Like, I truly feel like the way you make that content relevant, that's what we should be doing with education. And that's how we should be building bridges and making connections with people. And I feel like that gets lost a lot when we talk about, you know, what's important in education, what should we be funding,
things like that. I totally agree. I think that, because, you know, it's so funny. My goal in life had always been, and it's so funny because people would always ask, like, if you won the lottery, what would you do? Well, yes, I would be that girl who quit my job. I'm not going to pretend like I wouldn't. But like, my goal was to start a youth center here. Well, not here, but in Chicago, because I feel like down here, they do have exposure to so much more. The school that I'm at now, it's a relatively higher middle class. It's in a higher middle class environment here in Raleigh, a very affluent and well-to-do surrounding, you know, folks. And so that's quite different from that low socioeconomic status of, you know, the area that we worked in before. And so I think the goals here, although something like that is still necessary, I think there are other things that are far more important here. So like in Chicago, yes, I will be all over mental health because I can't help that. But the arts are the first things to go in the schools. Just having a place where kids could come and learn and do art. And I can't draw, I can't write poetry. I appreciate those things immensely. I have no skill set for them. But to give kids opportunities for those things and to expose them, you know, to those other things. That's why that program, oh, what was it called? Oh, I feel bad. You should remember too, because you were there with me when I was doing it.
Oh gosh.
First with an E, Don't Embark.
On the spot.
There you go. Our programs like Embark are so important. Yes. Embark was a program in Chicago where the founder believed that one of the main things that was keeping minority children down and behind with regards to achievement and everything else was their inability to be exposed to different opportunities and things. And so with Embark, we took kids to restaurants, we took them to plays, like just all kinds of different things to expose them to a different way of life, to expose them to different things. Down here, they have a little bit more exposure, right? Not everyone, but a lot of kids do. Like just if you think about like our PE program or arts, we have all kinds of art in this building. I mean, like kids can learn, we got 3 different languages we offer, like we do all kinds of stuff here that they don't even realize kids in Chicago would literally fight them for. I mean, like literally come down here and fist fight them for. And so now I think of places here, I think of, like I said, I think down here, the mental health aspect of it would be so privy for these kids, right? Because like they totally, I think there's so many kids just disenfranchised and marginalized down here. It looks so different. In Chicago, like all the kids were in the school, they were all poor, not poor, but they were all of a lower socioeconomic status. And so like, that's just what it was. Where I am now, the school is so diverse with socioeconomic statuses. You have some kids who travel out of the country every break we get. Like I've seen kids for their portfolio pictures standing on the tips of icebergs taking photographs. And I'm like, how can I be a part of your family? Whereas my kids in Chicago, many of them on the west side have never been downtown, and it's 5 minutes, 10 minutes away from them, right? So you talk about different types of exposure, but I just think that, you know, it's interesting because like I said, I used to say that I would start a youth center, and then it became, I would move to South Africa and start a school. Cause when I taught and studied abroad in South Africa in undergrad, changed my whole life. But now I'm looking at things and I think that there are so many things that I see myself being able to implement here within the walls of a school that I'm hoping that I can do well and maybe be a model to help, you know what I mean? Kind of spread that love around and let everyone see like, look, it can work. We can love. See what happens when we love each other and we teach kids to think? Like it can work, right? And so that's what I'm hoping to do and fulfill, you know, once I become an administrator. It's a big feat.
It is, but if anybody's gonna do it, I feel like you are. So I have faith. So we talked about the COVID-19 pandemic. We talked about virtual teaching, all the challenges that come along with that. You also have been teaching this year specifically in the middle of a very, let's say, chaotic election period. What was that like
so,
for you?
Here is different. It's very different from Chicago. In Chicago, and let's be clear, I've never, ever, ever imposed my opinion on students. In fact, my kids back home would always be like, Miss Joshua, that's my maiden name. What do you think? And I'd be like, I don't know. You tell me what you think. And I'm very good for playing devil's advocate. I mean, my kids probably, there's no telling what they think my real life looks like because I'm on both sides of the spectrum, every argument we have, right? But down here, it's very one-dimensional for the most part. And so it's tough because I know my school district wants to be more diverse. I know that they want to embed more diversity within the curriculum, within staff and everything. But I've never in my life seen a place where it conforms so much to the people around it, despite knowing what the right thing is. Do you know what I mean? Like, we know, you see it. We're talking about this social the social justice piece or injustice that you see on the news on a regular basis, right? I can't talk about that in my classroom. I can't bring it up. Now, if I bring it up and kids bring information in, it can be discussed in that way. Whereas in Chicago, honey, I would bring in an article and we would talk about it. Like, I'm teaching a Raisin in the Sun now. It looks so different from when I taught it in Chicago. And it's interesting because when I would teach it in Chicago, I would talk about how, you know, you had white people who were used to being around white people. And so to see some black people come, they're kind of like, whoa, wait a minute now, what are you doing? We don't, hey, now wait a minute, you know? And I told them, you know, in an effort to be fair, not that I condone segregation or racism, I can imagine what it would be like, though, if there were some people that, if you're used to being around this group of people all your life, and now you have people that look different, you're like, wait a minute, I don't know if I like that. But the flip side of it is we all know that that's not how you grow. That's not the way the world really looks. And so teaching kids to have empathy with that group, as well as understanding why that was wrong, I think was very critical and important. Instead of just saying that those white people were, you know, but I don't have that liberty here. Mm-hmm. If I try to bring up race, or if I try to bring up, and I don't do politics, but if I try in any way to address it or bring it up, and I always do pros and cons on either, I've already had several conversations with administration about those things. Actually, the second week I got to my school, I had some issues with that. So I'll give you that, and then I'm going to tell you about voting. When I got here, we were teaching, I was about to teach night to a group of 10th graders. And so for this engagement piece, and this is right when Trump enlisted the travel ban. And so what I did is I put kids in groups of like four, and I basically told them, we started with, okay, in the middle of the night, someone comes to your home and they tell you, you can take three things. What three things do you take and why? You can take two people. What two people do you take and why? So eventually we get it down to the point where at this table, you can only take one person, and the rest of them, they might die. They might, who knows what happens to them? Who do you take? And it was very unsettling and uncomfortable, which I liked. It's good. It should be, because the Holocaust was just that. So we do the assignment, we debrief, we talk about it. And I said, well, that was my anticipation guide for night. I said, because for many people, many Jews during the Holocaust, this was their reality, right? You may have had some cousins and friends who were hiding. You may have been that person hiding, and you hope that they don't rat you out. You hope that they don't find you. You know what I mean? Like you. And so one of the kids was like, this is stupid. Why are we doing this anyway? This isn't real. This would never happen. And I was like, why do you say that? So I brought in an article that talked about the pros and cons of the travel ban. And it addressed both sides because some people were saying that it was to make America more safe. Some people were saying that it was racism. I wanted them to look at the idea of excluding a group of people based solely on ethnicity, period. Nothing else, right? And so I told them, and there were some Middle Eastern students in my class. I said, many of you could go away for Christmas and not come back, or not be allowed to come back, and this is your home. No, you're not going to a crematorium. No, no one's gonna shoot you, right? You won't die. But it's this idea that you could be excluded and removed from your home based on nothing else but your ethnicity. Mm-hmm. And so we talked about it, and a lot of kids were like, I didn't even think about it that way. Honey, by the end of the day, I had a parent call up to the school. I had a parent-teacher conference the next day. I hadn't been at my school for 2 weeks, not even. I mean, it's so funny because the administrator, he met me in the office and he was like, Ms. Joshua, because we have four assistant principals and a principal. I got interviewed by one AP. I hadn't even met the principal yet, honey. He's like, Ms. Joshua? I go, yeah. He was like, hi, I'm blah, 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 blah. I'm your administrator. And when I saw him, I was like, this white guy's going to throw me under the bus and roll all over me. It's over. I go to this meeting, this mom was like, with the political climate being what it is, do you really think that it was a professional and great and executive decision for you to? And I was like, is she talking to me like, wait, I'm the teacher, no? Like, did you look at the assignment? Like, did you? The assistant principal, to this day, he has no idea, but I am forever indebted to him. He doesn't even know it. If he needs a kidney or an organ, he can have mine. If it's good, he gets it. Because he told her, he said, with all due respect, ma'am, he was like, I applaud Miss Joshua because, you know, our county is moving towards a more diverse curriculum. And we want kids to be able to make those connections with the world today. And we want them to be able to see how the world is ever changing, but not all at the same time. And so he said, I commend her for being bold enough to even address or attempt to make that kind of connection with students in an effort to get our kids engaged. You all have no idea. I could have kissed that man in the mouth. He saved my life that day. But that was one of many conversations that I've had. Fast forward that to the previous election we just had. So I go to vote, and as I drove up to the polls, the way it was set, it's set up here is kind of like, it's not in a forest, but it would remind you of that being from Chicago, because you drive through like all these trees and there's like this kind of roundabout, and the polling place was like in the roundabout. As I'm driving up, there was a caravan of Trump supporters lining up for I don't know what, but they had their flags, they had their Trump signs. You all, when I tell you, and I'm not overly emotional. Half the time, I don't care about people and what they do. Like, whatever. As long as it doesn't bother me, I don't really care what you do, Sweet Pea. And if it's not hurting anyone, it's not bothering me, whatever. But as I drove, and I mean, it was like 50 cars. I mean, like literally, there were so many. They were on both sides of the street. And before I got to the parking lot, I was just, I immediately started sobbing. And this was like lip quiver, nose running, like, this was bad crying. This was not attractive. This is not the movie Come Save Me, Man cry. Like, it was horrible. And all I could think about was this must have been how Black people felt in the presence of the Klan. Now, I'm not saying that that Trump supporters are that by any stretch of the imagination. I have people I'm friends with who are Trump supporters. So I don't feel like that. But that brazen boldness to be right outside of a polling place like that, it took me out. It took me back. I've never seen anything like that in my life. Almost cultish. You know what I mean? I've never seen anything like that. And it shook me to my core. So I sat in the parking lot, I called one of my friends from Chicago, and I just started crying. And I was like, I don't even know why I'm this emotional. They didn't do anything to me. They didn't put their hands on me. Nobody touched me. But I had to get myself together before I could go in a polling place. And so she kind of talked me off the ledge, and she was like, it's okay. With racial tensions being as high as they are, I understand. So I go in and I vote and I come out. That caravan flooded the parking lot, y'all. Honking their horns, sticking their flags out the car, bumping, I don't know what kind of music, and, you know, support Trump, you know, and I was just like, are you kidding me? It was so bad, no one could enter or exit the parking lot. This was probably 20 minutes before the polls were to close, and this was the last day of early voting here. And so they flooded the lot, and I had to wait for them to leave, as they shouted out their car windows. And, you know, I just stood there. I was like frozen, and I couldn't do anything but cry. And like I said, I will curse you out. Do you understand me? I am from the south side of Chicago, honey. My mouth. But I didn't have any words. Like, I couldn't even, I was just stoic. I was stuck. And even after they left, I sat in my car for like 15 minutes. I was appalled. But that was very common here. Not necessarily them flooding the parking lot like that, but you would see caravans on the highway. You would see the caravans driving through neighborhoods. Like, they were like everywhere. They were everywhere, everywhere. I didn't see a single Biden and Kamala caravan, but those And that's what I mean when I say it was almost like cultish. You know what I mean? And it was very frightening. I've never experienced anything like that in my entire life.
I feel like that probably was the purpose, though, right? Was that fright and that fear-inducing thing that
they did it? For. I mean, that intimidation. It. I hate to be the one to admit it, because, you know, I pretend like I'm tough all day, but. That, when I tell you, that broke me in a way that I've never been broken before. I've never had an emotional reaction to anything like that aside from someone passing away in my life. I didn't cry like that when my husband proposed. Like,
yeah.
And I couldn't, I think the thing that trips me out about it the most, I couldn't articulate it. I had no words, and I felt stupid because I couldn't manage my emotions. I felt, I guess, equally as unintelligent because no one physically harmed me, but I was crying like I was abused, like I was beat. No one said anything to me. Like, no one did anything to me personally for me to feel that way. You know, I mean, I cried when I saw George Floyd, though. I definitely did. And I cried when they killed, what is his name? It escapes me now. George Zimmerman's baby. Yeah, I cried when they killed, because that was somebody's child. And to watch George begging like that for so long, that shook me to my core. But I didn't cry like that when I was polling, and no one did anything to me. It just seemed so irrational to me.
Yeah. I mean, I can only imagine what that must have felt like. I mean, it really sounds like that was on some level kind of a trauma response almost. Like, that's what that sounds like to me, is the body reacting.
Yeah, and you know what's interesting, really, a little personal note and making a connection even now. My great-grandfather was lynched, and my sister did some genealogy stuff when she was in college, and we found a couple of relatives, and so they sent my sister some pictures of my great-grandfather, and I have them of him on a stretcher after they lynched him with his bruised and beaten body. And in thinking about that, like, I can only imagine, and I'm not saying that what I felt by any means was what he felt and experienced, but I can only imagine the fear that I felt in that moment. My goodness. And now imagine if they had the power and potential to hurt me, how that would have felt, because I can only imagine what that must have been like for him in that moment, you know? So yeah, it was a very real experience, unfortunately.
Wow. It brings me back to the idea, and I am by no means an expert on this at all, but the historical transmission of trauma. I mean, even though you may have not experienced something like your great-grandfather did, there's a transmission of it. And the fact that you felt it, you might not have been able to, consciously be aware of what was happening. You certainly felt it. And I'm just angry and frustrated.
You know, the interesting thing, though, you said you were angry.
Experience that.
Out of all the emotions that I felt, anger wasn't it. Anger wasn't it. And I think it's interesting because when I called my friend, when I told her that this must be what it felt like during the civil rights movement. This must be what it felt like during slavery, right? Like when we were in a place where we weren't, because I felt like I didn't belong, like I wasn't supposed to be there. Like, you know, like there's a certain level of privilege that those folks were afforded. And don't think that there were Black people out there with them too, you know? So like, I don't want anybody to think that it was just a group of white people being, you know, like there were Black folks out there. But anger was not, I can't say that was my initial reaction. I think if anything, the idea that it is 2020 and we are still experiencing things like that. Do you understand? Yeah. It's 2020 and those types of emotions can still be evoked in us. That's a problem. That's a problem. The fact that if I get pulled over, I'm nervous and sweatier than you can imagine. That's a problem. You know, and you think about it, like you teach your kids to, the police are supposed to help. I will never, my husband can beat me brainless. He doesn't put his hands on me, but I'm just saying, I will never call the police on him, ever. You hear me? I will never call the police on a person of color. I will not do it. I will not. You have to like really, really, really be accosting me. I will not do it, because whatever you're doing, my first reaction will be, Do I want this person to die for this? Would I be okay if this person died? Probably not, mm-hmm. because I'm that person. I can't imagine wanting someone to die. And it's tough that those are the split decisions I'd have to, like, if someone were breaking in my house, I think I would think twice before I called the police, though. You know what I mean? We are legal gun owners here. And so, we might handle some things before they get here, but my first reaction probably would not be, depending on who that person is and their disposition. I cannot honestly say my first reaction would be to call the police. Well, I mean, because if I think about it, if they come in, this is my house. Will they think that it's my house? Will they know that it's my house? Right. Will they care that it's my house? I'm just honest, you know? And if anything were to happen and, you know, they decide to, you know, pull their weapons, like, with in some shape, form, or fashion, it doesn't seem to be punishable for them. And so I would probably see if I can, you know, maybe handle some things in my own way on my own. And then, okay, so he shot in the knee. He can't move. Can you get him now? Right? Look, it's my house. Yes. Can you, right? Like, I feel like I need to have a clearance to be able to explain myself, as opposed to like, hey, there's someone in my home who should be. Can you come, you know, can you help me? No.
Right. Yeah. You know, I don't want to cut this off at all or cut it short at all. I feel like this is really important and we, you know, but I also feel like I'm keeping you longer than we planned on keeping you. So I want to respect your time as well. But having said all that and having talked about some really heavy things on the episode today, I'm wondering, you know, without diminishing all of that, I'm wondering if there's anything at all right now that's bringing you hope.
So when I think about some of my students, right, and I think about some of them, even ones I've taught down here in North Carolina, I think about some of them who've reached back, or, you know, when we talk about things like social media, it gives me hope. And I don't want to be that mushy gushy person, but when I see my kids doing well, and I see my kids being community activists, and I see my kids doing well, doing things for other people, it warms my soul. It reminds me that there is hope, right? Because, you know, I'll see some, especially more than any other group. And I love my DuSable, my BSI kids. That's my first school. Those are my first babies. They will always be my first love. And when I tell you, they are thriving, many of them. But when I see my kids from the West Side, particularly, and I see those kids who have beat the odds and beat the statistics, right? Like, so many of my boys would talk to me candidly about not thinking they're going to make it to adulthood, right? To see them now have families, to see them now be working. And I'm not saying that they have to be like super wealthy and well off, but, you know, one of my students was doing something, not this year, maybe it was last year, where he was giving out like book bags or something. It was some kind of community thing. And I was like, that just warmed my heart. It gives me hope, because when I feel like I'm not enough, or I feel like, you know, the world is just so corrupt, it's so chaotic, and everything is amok. When I see my kids and I know where they've come from, I know what they've been through. I know how many of them don't have fathers. I know how many of them have had incarcerated parents or have a parent who has passed away, or, you know, all of these things that I can't fathom having to have dealt with at their ages. And I see them thriving and I see them doing well, not only for themselves, but for others. It gives me hope. And then also looking at some of my kids, even here, seeing some of them and the things that they're doing now, or even having kids who have a student who was transferred recently into my classroom. He's an Hispanic student. And I got observed by two administrators. And one of the administrators was like, Irvin, such and such, he actually speaks in your class. Now, English is not his first language, honey. She's like, I've seen him at math classes and in this class. And, you know, he doesn't talk. He doesn't hardly do any work. And I said, well, he stays all the time after class with me. He stayed after class today with me, right? I would have never known that about him. That gives me hope, because that is a kid who typically probably would have fallen through the cracks based on what this administrator is telling me, right? That gives me hope that that kid will keep going. That gives me hope that that kid will make it. You know, being a teacher is so much more than teaching English. And I've told my kids over the years, I don't care if you learn English. This is bigger than that. English is my heart. It's my love. I love to read. I love writing. I like those things. It's okay if it's not your thing. My goal is to make you a better human when you leave this room than when you came in. My goal is to make sure that you can function beyond the walls of this school building, right? And I'm hoping that through the literature, through the reading, through the writing, I can get you to that place. But even if I can't through those avenues, we're going to do some things in this class that will expose you hopefully to some ideas, some concepts, some philosophies and pedagogies and all these other things that will help you to be able to think your way through life beyond here. And so when I see those things manifesting kids and when I see kids doing well, that is what gives me hope. Because I'm only one person, right? But when I can see, if I can run off a list of, you know, 30, 40, 50, 100 kids that I probably could think of, and I see it on social media, it warms my soul. And it lets me know that we'll be okay, because those are the people who are gonna be taking care of me. And I feel like I'm in good hands for the most part. There's some right? But to see them succeeding, that gives me hope. Because so many of them statistically aren't supposed to still be here. They aren't supposed to be married. They aren't supposed to be doing well, but they are, right? They aren't supposed to care about other people, but they do. And so that is my anchor. And that is what keeps me grounded and gives me hope.
That's beautiful. I mean, that must just be an incredible feeling, especially being a teacher who has taught for so long and has taught so many kids, to be able to see that. And that is a positive of social media, that like now we can actually see what's going on with some of these kids. That must be an incredible feeling. I mean, I see them all over your Facebook all the time.
Yeah, so sure I definitely, like, you know, I don't have kids of my own. But so if I tallied up all the kids I've taught over the years, I guess those are all my babies. And it's so funny because I tell them, like, I don't care how old you are, you're still my baby. Like, you're always going to be my baby. They still call me Miss Joshua or Miss Irvin. And I have kids as old as 30 now, 30 something, actually, tell anybody. But I'm still Miss Irvin. I'm not Wendy. They still don't know my real first name, right? But it's just being able to see them succeed, I think, is the greatest gift. And I'm not saying it because it sounds like something that should be put on a Hallmark card. It is a real thing, because I get to know my kids and I know where they're coming from. I know what they've been through. And to see them defy the odds and make it, there's no gift greater than that.
Definitely. Well, we have one more question for you, Wendy. Carly, do you want to do the honors on this one?
Sure. So as we reflect back, maybe we can even go back 12 months now. I think it's gotten to that time where we can look back a full year. I'm wondering if you can reflect back and really think about something that you've really learned, something that you've cultivated, and how you imagine that kind of playing out.
That's a very good question. Something that I have learned is that I have to be more, I don't want to use the term versatile, because that's not what it is, but I'm learning the significance of making my message palatable for multiple groups of people, right? Because back home, I told you I was comfortable. I could let my hair down and be myself and still be professional. I could, you know, like, sometimes the lines with church and state might get a little blurry. You know, I got some friends here that I work with, that I hang out with outside of work, and they're on my team. And, you know, like, it was very easy to fall into that. Whereas here, it's very like, this is professional life, this is personal life, right? But because I would be comfortable, I would be more inclined to speak more freely. And it's not to say that everything that I say is calculated now, because it's not. But I am more deliberate and intentional with what I say, how I say it, and why I'm saying it, right? And I am very intentional about messaging so that I can, once again, be more palatable for, you know, multiple groups of people. It's one thing to get Black teachers to be like, I like her. But it's a whole nother thing to sell it and package it to some teachers who may or may not think that they like me, right? And so I think that has been my greatest lesson, is something that is ever evolving. I'm constantly working on it because the truth of the matter is I'm outnumbered here, right? I mean, and when I say outnumbered, it's not just a race thing. Just being from the city, on a big and a big city like Chicago, we move fast, we think quick, we're on our toes all the time. Everything is just different here. And I have to always be cognizant of how I'm presenting information so that it is welcomed and hopefully accepted by the masses, right? Whereas before I could just say what I wanted to say and like, it was cool. Now I have to think about how I'm going to say that. How am I going to package that? How am I going to take a teacher who, like I said, despite whatever their background may be, they may not think that I deserve this position. They may not think that I know what I'm talking about. They may think that because I don't always pronounce the R in car, that I'm not that intelligent. So how do I get my message across in a way that they will listen, accept it, and then also be willing to act on it, right? So that's been a really huge lesson for me. And like I said, it's ever evolving, but I'm learning, because if I'm going to make change here, I have to be able to impact and influence and motivate everybody, not just people that look like me or not just people who understand me. So that is my ongoing lesson.
Beautiful. I think we can all learn a lot from you, Lindy. And honestly, thank you so, so much for being with us today, for sharing all of your wisdom. I think we definitely at some point in the future need to do a part two to this, because I didn't get to ask you all the questions I wanted to ask you. So, but seriously, thank you so much.
Well, thanks we really so much. I'm you. Grateful to you all too. You guys are doing great work, by the way.
Thank you.
So I'm happy to be like one of the first people. So you all blew up. I could be like, I was one of the first guests.